Accession number 15327, Reel 1.
Mr. Angel Beck, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
West Kirby in Cheshire.
Which year was this?
1917.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a lecturer in geography at Liverpool University. And he died when I was five in 1922, largely as a result of war wounds that he got in the 1418 war.
Did you go to school at West Kirby?
No. I was brought up in the country in Cheshire and went to school in Crewe to start off with, and then I went off to public school at Bromsgrove in Worcestershire, and from there I went on to Brasenose College, Oxford.
What were you doing when Chamberlain made his war declaration?
I was in the garden at my mother's home in Crewe. And I just remember the announcement coming over the radio.
And what was your reaction?
Well, it was really one of almost relief, because we'd been living for a long time under the threat of war. And I think it was almost a relief to hear that something was actually happening. And I was doing nothing at the time. I'd just come down from Oxford in June and was about to start a job with Unilever in September. But the war then was coming, and that job wasn't confirmed. So I went straight into the Navy.
How did you go about getting into the Navy?
Well, they had in those days things called joint recruiting boards. These were rather fun, actually, because they were held at the university. And as you'll appreciate, there were a lot of ex-service people who had been in fairly senior positions, who had got jobs in the university. And then when the war broke out, they formed this joint recruiting board, and they then put on their uniforms again and became sort of military people. And for example, the chairman of my particular board was my surveying tutor, who'd been a major general in the Indian Army and had done a major survey of India. And he was there with all his little red tabs and everything, and was very helpful because to me, because I when I went up to Oxford in 1936, I joined the Senior Officers Training Corps, OTC, because I could get free riding. And having been in that for some time, in 1938, you had to sit an examination called Certificate B. When you were at school, you took a certificate called Certificate A, and that was a sort of an OTC qualification. But the Certificate B was normally taken by people who were in the senior OTC at Oxford, and the only people who normally passed it were the university intake for the army. So all the other people automatically failed. But in 1938, we all had to sit this exam, and to our absolute horror, we all passed. And so we thought, when we got the results, we said, what on earth have we done here? Because we've just presented ourselves as cannon fodder. Well, I was a bit apprehensive, because I didn't want to go into the army, although this examination qualified me to take a gunnery commission in the regular army without any further training. So when I went up to this joint recruiting board, I was a bit apprehensive that I was just going straight into the army, in spite of any other inclination I had. But when I was asked what I wanted to do, I said I wanted to go into the Navy. And there was an old admiral who was on the board and said, "Well, why do you want to go into the Navy?" And I said, "Well, I'm quite fond of sailing." And his comment to that was, "Well, sailing, well, there's be steam rather a lot in the Navy these days." And anyway, why do you want to go into the Navy as opposed to the Army? And that thing, my old surveying tutor, whose name I've forgotten, I'm afraid, said, "Well, of course, I'd read geography at the university. His geographical training will be very useful to him in the Navy." And there was a bit of barney between them, and they said, "All right, well, you can go into the Navy." Well, this was in October 1939, and I suppose they weren't very fussed. As long as they could get you into some service or other, I don't suppose they were particularly worried which you went into at that time.
What was your next step?
We were, having been taken on, we were all sent to an underground garage in Brighton, which hadn't been completed, but it was an enormous thing, all underground, and it went by the title of King Alfred, HMS King Alfred. And it was really rather amusing at that time, because this was in October again, 1939, and all the people, or the majority of people, who were there, the same intake as me, were former, I should think probably about, at least 75% were either Oxford or Cambridge people, and it was just like going to a university JCR. You knew an awful lot of them anyway, and it was terrific fun. I mean, we were billeted out in flats and hotels in Brighton and Hove, and we just did our training at this underground garage. That went on, from memory, for about 3 weeks, at the end of which they regarded us as being qualified. At the end of that period, we were going on to our next step. And the next step was to go to the old airship hangars at Cardington, at Bedford, because the plan at that time was to send the fleet to sea with barrage balloons on them as a deterrent to aircraft. So we went to Cardington, where we just flew balloons. I mean, it was really rather pathetic in many ways with hindsight, but we flew balloons, and that went on for some weeks until they decided that that wasn't a starter. So we were then virtually the same crowd. There must have been about 50 of us, I suppose. We were all sent to Portland, to HMS Osprey, which was the anti-submarine training centre. And we all trained as anti-submarine officers on ASDIC.
What kind of equipment did they have in those days?
Well, it was all pretty simplistic. It was the basic anti-submarine gear, which was just a sound. It was a transmitter that sent out a ray, a sound ray, or whatever you like to call it. And if that hit something solid, it would come back, so you'd have a reply. It went out as a ping, and it hit the echo, and you get an echo coming back. And the general idea then was that you kept trained on this where you were getting the echo, and you just approached it, and then at the appropriate moment you dropped your depth charges. It was all very, very basic.
Did it inspire you with confidence that you would be able to locate?
Oh, well, I mean, we thought in those days that it must be absolutely marvellous, you know. I mean, in real terms, it was very limited in its capacity. But it did work, but it only had a range, I suppose, of about, my guess would be about a couple of miles or something like that. So if you imagine you're in the at sea, you can only pick up an echo from a couple of miles ahead, and you've then got to hit that particular echo at that moment. So it's a bit hit and miss. And it was only as radar came in much later on, that things became more sophisticated. This original equipment was much the thing that people like Johnny Walker used, but what they did and what they developed was two ships working as a team, and one would pick up the echo, and the other one then would be the one that dropped the depth charges, so that you could be pretty accurate as to where the actual submarine was. And at that time, I think their equipment, I mean, I stayed in small ships all my war, and we didn't get the best equipment, but obviously they improved the quality of the equipment. And destroyers and frigates got that. But I was in trawlers for the whole of my war, and we only got the the basic, shall we say.
How long were you doing this course at Portland?
Again, a matter of weeks. I should think probably a month at the outside. And then that would probably take us to about March 1940, when I went up to Aberdeen to join some of the northern boats, which were the trawlers. Oh, one slight amusing thing, the luck of the draw. When we'd finished our training at Osprey, which is Portland, and we were allocated to ships, and I'd been allocated to a tribal class destroyer, which were the epitome of a modern man of war. They were very large destroyers, almost a cross between a destroyer and a cruiser, and they were very highly regarded. And a bloke who was on the course with me, he was appointed to a trawler. And he was absolutely devastated. And he said, "God, you know, this is dreadful. I've just got one of these bloody trawlers. And you've got a tribal class destroyer." So I said, "Well, if you want to, I don't mind swapping." And he said, "You wouldn't, would you?" So we swapped. I mean, it was all fairly happy-go-lucky in those days. So I had my draft altered to his trawler, and he went to my tribal class destroyer, and they were lost with all hands about a fortnight later. I can't remember what the name of the ship was, actually, but that was the end of him. And so I went on up to Aberdeen and joined the trawlers.
Can you tell me about the ship that you joined?
The first one I joined was the Northern Pride. These were an interesting group of trawlers. There were 18 of them. They were built by the Germans for Unilever. because they couldn't get money out of Germany in the 70s. So, but they did agree that they would build this, or could build this fleet of trawlers, which were very large ocean-going affairs, and they formed a nucleus of trawlers for Unilever. And they were all at Aberdeen when I got there, and it was one of these, the Northern Wave, that I Northern Pride, that I joined, it was again an interesting little setup. There were four in those days. There were four officers and a crew, I should think, of about 40, 45. And our CO was an old RNR ex-merchant service skipper. And he was a teetotaler. Well, in those days, we didn't bother about signing particular chits for all our liquor. We just took it and divided it once a month. But and we paid our mess bills at the end of the month. But we never bothered about charging for soft drinks at all. But old Cappy Campbell, the skipper, he was a teetotaler. And we found in the end that he was drinking a hell of a lot more in monetary terms out of his soft drinks than we were drinking out of our gin and our whiskey. So we had to alter the system.
Was he an Aberdeen man?
No, I don't know where he came from. No, it was just quite fortuitous that we were all in Aberdeen at that time. I think the ships were registered in Hull. But there was quite a big trawler group in Aberdeen at that time. I can't think how many, there must have been 20 or 30 of them. And this was one of the joys of trawlers, because we kept together virtually throughout the whole of the war, and there was a terrific camaraderie built up between us all. We went all round, we got around very well. I mean, ultimately we went to Gib, the Azores, Newfoundland, Iceland, Russia, Norway. But we all kept very much together, and were based initially in Aberdeen. And then from there we went up to Scapa, and that would be about late March, I would think, 1940. And we went to Aberdeen, to Scapa, just, quote, to await orders. We were there, I remember, for the Norwegian campaign. One thing that always intrigued me up there, which I've never seen referred to since, but in Scapa, they had... certainly an aircraft carrier and a battleship, and there may have been others, but these were completely bogus. They were made. I don't know if you've heard anything at all about these, but they were just dummies that were left there as potential targets for the Germans, who came over fairly often and dropped a few bombs. But I've never heard anything about them since, what the background was or how many of them there were. And we were there in until the Germans invaded Norway, and then we were sent to Narvik. Actually, the base in that part of the world was a place called Harstad, which became the base for the Norwegian field of operation.
Were you still in Northern Pride?
I was still in Northern Pride then, but I then was moved from Northern Pride to Northern Wave, and in fact I spent most of the Norwegian campaign in Northern Wave. No, I beg your pardon. I went to Norway in Northern Gem, which was very much a ship manned by former fishermen. The skipper was a former fishing skipper by name of Laurie Scarlett, and most of the crew were former fishermen.
From
Hull and Grimsby. Well, I don't think my face fitted very well with Laurie Scarlett, because we had a resounding row where I was most insubordinate, in that we were on patrol off a place called Svolvær in the Lofoten Islands, and on one day there was a little Norwegian fisherman in his little fishing boat, and he gave us a whole lot of fish, pulled his lines in. They were long line fishermen, and he picked his lines up, and he gave us almost enough fish to feed the complete ship's company, which was jolly nice of him, I thought. Well, the following day, I was asleep in my bunk, but was awakened because I heard the ship backing and filling and engines going and God knows what. And so I shoved my nose out and said, what the hell's going on? And a member of the crew, who was obviously highly incensed, said, oh, old Scarlett's overhauling that old Norwegian's lines. So I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, he's just overhauling his lines and he's going to pinch all his fish. So I steamed up to the bridge and really let him have it. I never knew anything like this in all my life. I mean, I should have been court-martialed, really. But in the end, he obviously didn't think much of me, and I didn't think much of him. So he engineered for me to have a transfer to Northern Wave, which suited me very well because I liked the CO much better. And I spent the rest of the Norwegian campaign in Northern Wave.
He was just taking this chap's fish?
He was just going to take his fish. He didn't do it in the end. I think I put him off. I mean, so we then all we did was to patrol a place called Offord Fjord, which is. I think it's a bit farther up the Vestfjord, above the Lofoten Islands, really at the entrance to Narvik. And there were two interesting things there that happened. Again, I told you about my luck at not going on to this tribal-class destroyer. Having changed from Northern Gem to Northern Wave, the Northern Gem had a very exciting experience. They were on patrol, and it was reported to them that a German aircraft had come down, and they were to land a landing party to go and find out what was happening. So when they landed this, they put a boat ashore and sent a landing party off. And when the landing party arrived on shore, all hell was let loose. They were absolutely shattered gunfire. And it turned out that this German aircraft was in fact a troop carrier that come down, and it was full of paratroops who were going to land at Narvik, but they didn't get quite that far. But they killed a number of the crew, and the rest were taken prisoner, and they were prisoner for quite a few days until I think the Resolution, which is a battleship, came up, and they landed a party of Marines, and they rescued these people who'd been taken prisoner. That it wasn't finished then, because the old Northern Gem was still on patrol, and they came across a little Norwegian chuff, very little fishing boats that known as puffers, because they went chuff 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 chuff, they stopped this. The bloke who replaced me, or who I'd swapped with, was put aboard this little puffer with one or two ratings to see what was going on down below. And the moment they got on board, a bloke ran out with an axe and attacked this poor little man, and he was very badly injured with an axe wound in his back, and he was quite ill, quite seriously wounded. But then the Northern Gem raked the ship with gunfire, I think a lot of the Norwegians were killed. And they then went on board to see what was happening, and they found, I think, about two or three women and a few children down below. It transpired that why they should have thought this, I don't know, but apparently these Norwegians thought that Northern Gem were Germans. So it was one of these unfortunate occasions. What else comes to mind with the Norwegian campaign? Most of it was really pretty dull. I mean, we were bombed fairly regularly because it was an ideal area for the Germans to have target practice. But we just went up and down, and we watched the ships like the Resolution going up to Narvik and bombarding it and so on. We then had one or two interesting times in Harstad, which had been bombed fairly regularly, and there were one or two merchant ships that had been sunk, but they were still, they'd been beached and they were there. But the one the bit that sticks out most in my mind was towards the end, when it was obvious that we were going to leave Norway, because the Germans were moving north steadily, and they would bomb a place and absolutely flatten it, and then they'd move to the next one farther north and flatten that. And they'd flattened a place called Bodø, B-O-D-O, which was a bit farther south of Harstad, and it was quite apparent that the next one was going to be Harstad. But fortunately, we then got low cloud, and visibility was virtually nil from the aircraft's point of view. And in the meantime, it was announced that we were going to evacuate. So we were told that we'd got to stay alongside until the very last, when the anti-aircraft crews, who they'd stay, as it were, on duty as long as they could. But when it was decided that they were to evacuate, these anti-aircraft crews were going to come